This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 77 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we decide to borrow an old TT Type 40 Mark III that was in for repair, fly it around with five less than the required pilots, habitually push the doors open when they do, obviously say pull, and yet always end up where we need to be, with the care and the oversight of our one true and constant companion, the TARDIS. Joining in the GPR studios this evening is Keir. Glad to have you with us. And Jay is joining me as well. Jay, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Equally fantastic. Been looking forward to this one.
Oh, yeah.
For some time. So if you haven't gathered from the intro this week, we're going to be looking into what we personally consider to be the program's second constant and yet ever-changing, just as our primary character does, and that being the TARDIS. Now, she has been there since the absolute first adventure, and as we know from what we saw take place in the Fields of Trenzalore, she will be there until the very bitter end. So throughout everything, in all of the space and time that she carries us through, just like the Doctor himself, as the decades and the centuries pass, she will always have new secrets for us to uncover and new abilities to be learned. So... Okay.
This is exciting. I mean, we've been batting this around for a couple of weeks, and we'd keep on like, is it time yet? Can we talk about the TARDIS yet? Come on.
Well, it goes back farther than weeks. I mean, we started talking about Who Tech months and months ago.
Yeah.
I want to say at least 4 or 5 months ago. We intentionally left the TARDIS off the list because we didn't, in a sense, first of all, we knew it was going to be too big of a topic to be able to lump in with anything else. But secondly, it almost feels wrong to discuss the TARDIS as simply a piece of Whovian technology.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so much more than that. You know, it's at first it was just, it was theorized, or the concept was that, you know, this was his ship. This is how he gets around. This is, you know, it's just a little box and we're going to paint it like a phone booth and it's just going to be great. And it became so much more very, very quickly.
Right. Yep. They had no idea of at least in some of the initial pennings of the first few episodes as to whether or not it was going to maintain. There was a reason why it was maintaining the shape of the police box. The writers back in some of the early concepts actually named it as the TARDIS, you know, capital T, lowercase ARDIS, because they were naming it as a vessel, just as we would name, you know, the Amistad or any other, you know, seafaring vessel. And it wasn't until they started getting a little farther along with it in the writing process that they decided to give it, this acronym basis that they handed to Barbara to explain during Unearthly Child. Mm-hmm. And even that in and of itself has been kind of called into question because of the fact that other Time Lords, other individuals who are not necessarily in any way cognizant of the discussions that the Doctor had had with his grandfather as to why it was even called the TARDIS at all, you know, or what that acronym stood for. It became almost an accepted, even though we know by technical terminology, it's known as a TT Type 40 capsule, you know, Mark III. I mean, you see that on the little dedication plaque just inside the doorway when in the episode "Let's Kill Hitler." So that's your technical specs on that regard. But
So we know what the TARDIS is. You know, it's a Time Lord vessel used to, you know, as research platforms for gathering historical data, you know, things like that. It's an exploratory vessel. Yeah, this is their car to go and do the sciencey stuff. Yeah,
right. Well, there's it's interesting that if you categorize it exclusively or at least primarily as a research vessel, it's interesting to note when people say, all right, well, if you're going to start getting into some of these real tech aspects, this is a type 40. You know, what does that mean? Well, and it was considered obsolete by the time the doctor started utilizing it, as we learn from some of the aspects when you see the day of the doctor or name of the doctor, I'm sorry, and the name of the doctor, the bag of the doctor, book of the doctor,
of the doctor,
they're describing it as it's a repair unit. It's sitting there on the shop floor because it's this obsolete old vessel that's, you know, essentially they're going to try to, you know, revive it one more time or maybe turn it over for scrap. But the type classification on it matters, because if you get into some of the prose or the audiobooks and things like that, you start realizing that as you get up into, you know, the type 80 classes, the type 90 classes, or even I think they went as high as like 104, that was when they started getting retrofitted for war use. And you had war-designated TARDISes that were fitted that way because they realized that the likelihood of a time war was going to come about. Not necessarily they didn't know that it was going to be, you know, particularly with the Daleks, but right. That sort of a threat in terms of maintaining the order and the laws of time was going to get to something that had almost a military standing. So they started getting retrofitted.
So let that sink in for a minute. They had battle TARDISes. I mean, come on. How awesome is that?
Awesome, but a little kind of frightening as well. I mean,
terrifying.
We knew that they had, you know, extensive defense systems defined for them. You know, everything from just and we'll go through some of these ones, the ones that we're more familiar with, like the chameleon circuit when it worked. you know, the HADS system, or even down to just the key itself. You know, the fact that, you know, in that manifestation, as we know, of that simple 60s police box, you had a key in the door. If you didn't have that key, you didn't get into the damn thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or the fact that there were aspects of it that were like isomorphic defenses, so that unless it was the doctor himself at the moment, regardless of a key, unless it was the doctor's touch at that handle or at the control panel, TARDIS did not open or did not move. You know, so it was, even though this was considered to be a research vessel, it had a lot of defensive mechanisms inherently built within it because of the fact that it harnessed so much power and so much potential danger if it fell into the wrong hands.
Mm-hmm. Or even if it just fell into untrained hands, really. I mean, we've seen how much hassle this machine can cause, and, you know, all the problems that come about because, you know, it wasn't handled properly or something went wrong or something like that. This is like 5,000 times more dangerous than a nuclear bomb, and we've got it flying around space. You know, it's like you want somebody that knows what they're doing behind the controls.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't always the doctor.
No, that's seldom the doctor, actually. But
right. Well, one of the things that keeps coming around, or at least came around quite a bit in Classic Who, and then it started getting challenged a little bit as we started getting towards, Pandorica and issues of that nature, was the indestructibility of the TARDIS. You know, was this, as the Seventh Doctor often described it, as virtually indestructible, but he also said things like virtually impregnable, always with those caveats that, you know, there's no, we are not speaking literally, we are only speaking virtually.
Right.
So leaving the door open for certain things. But that was something that writers had to deal with quite a bit, because if you had something where, the Ark in Space. Okay, so Fourth Doctor is dealing with this issue of all these people that have to escape this remote satellite and before they're all completely obliterated, and you've got a TARDIS that's literally sitting there. Just open the doors, let the humanoids in, disappear. You're done in 10 minutes.
Right.
As soon as a risk is assessed. How are you dragging this out to an hour and 20 minutes? But they look at it as, you know, if you fall into that trap of saying, well, you've got this easy out anytime you need it, how are we going to, you know, keep ourselves from running into this over and over again? And to this day, I mean, we still run into another number of instances where you either have to come up with the HADS system, you know, think Cold War.
Yeah.
When the HADS system just renders the TARDIS inaccessible for 44 minutes. But they said, okay, there's going to be certain instances where we have to say, okay, this is a point in history that cannot be altered. Time cannot be manipulated. We have to allow these events to take place. You know, the risk has to be assessed, dealt with, and conquered without pulling a ripcord.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of gave that license, or they dealt with that bit of creative license by putting some bumpers on the sides of it.
Right.
But I mean, we've dealt with we've started broaching the topic of some of the capabilities and some of the technical aspects of the TARDIS in numerous episodes of ours before, talking about things like the different rooms that we've had exposure to. Many of them are, I should say, the vast majority of them, as far as exposure to some initial area or additional areas, have been during fifth and sixth Doctors.
Yeah, the actual exposure to it, yes, we've gotten a lot more rooms that have just been, you know, name checked, just given a name and, you know, talked about, but we've never actually seen.
Mm-hmm. But it even started from the early stages. I mean, we started thinking about things like, you know, we don't see a lot of people saying, you know, companions coming in, you know, wiping their hands down, saying, sorry, I was just in the restroom.
Right.
You know, that doesn't happen often. But even from some of the, take the second episode, first Doctor, second episode, Dead Planet, and we are dealing with the food machine, you know, so they've got a food replicator there, you know, where they can have bacon and eggs that come in these little foil packs the size of, they're smaller than MREs. I don't even know what they are. something from, more like Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, where you just pop in a capsule and or the Jetsons.
Right.
And you've got the taste of a full meal there. But yeah, I mean, we've dealt with some of the recurring elements like the library, which we finally got a chance to see in Journey to the Center.
Or the pool. Did we? Everything was reset. Did we actually see it?
Well, no. Yes. Yes, we did. We've had a couple of instances with the wardrobe, obviously, initially right around regeneration points where Doctor is trying on a few new outfits to determine his identity.
And we saw it with the sixth Doctor. We saw it with the tenth Doctor. You know, every now and again when we see them actually getting dressed instead of, you know, Tom Baker just coming out of the TARDIS in crazier and crazier outfits. Yeah. You know.
Still one of my favorite scenes.
Oh, yeah. Especially when he comes out in the little sad clown outfit. And then
the
he's got
Pagliacci, turn, yeah. Absolutely.
And then he turns around and just goes back in.
Opera.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and then we even have aspects where, you know, and I know we tend to besmirch it a bit, but there were some aspects of Journey to the Center of the TARDIS where we got some interesting elements like the Tree of Creation that was able to manifest objects as needed, you know. I mean, that's just the concept alone in that is kind of mind-boggling if you really start to take it apart. And that also gave us a beautiful insight, one of the most dramatic insights into things like the Eye of Harmony in the heart of the TARDIS,
right?
You know, which up to this point had just been sort of dealt with by handing you this little fist-sized box and saying, "Oh, well, you know, don't you be careful with that. That's really important."
Right.
The entire time vortex is in there. Just, you know, don't drop it. It's you know, insurance on that is worse than a cell phone.
Yeah. So I mean, we've gotten little bits here and there, and everything's been. If you put it together, I mean, there are pages and pages, and I mean, like entire wikis filled with this stuff. That's just people have gone through the minutiae and found every little bit and, you know, every little, you know, part that just doesn't correspond with anything else. And it's just, it's crazy the amount of knowledge that we have about this craft that just, you know, it fills these entire web pages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when it really comes down to what makes this such a compelling aspect of just the science of the Hooniverse is the fact that this is not only a vessel or a means of transportation for our primary characters, but it is a character in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had implications that there was the first signs of sentience, or even at times the ship itself defying its operator. Within the first two seasons. I mean, I think inside it was a first Doctor, you take the episode Inside the Spaceship, and there's a faulty switch on the control panel that as a result of it is not allowing the vessel to correct its own path as it's headed towards the you know, this destructive point at the creation of the solar system, you know, and it's about to be blown apart, but it is able to communicate with the occupants on a subconscious level, sort of a dream state level. Okay. So you're already getting some indication within the first year or two of them putting this program together that the ship itself is behaving in this personified way. You know, by the time we get around to Second Doctor, I think is one of the first ones to refer to her as the old girl. Third Doctor outright admits that it is a, or that she is a living thing. You know, he, I think it's, I'm trying to remember the exact episodes where it comes about, but he actually says outright that that she's alive. I think it's either Planet of the Spiders or Death to the Daleks or one of those where he says, you know, she's a living thing. You know, all of her thousands of instruments are all part of a living core. And then Ninth Doctor, you know, references that again as he's explaining what the TARDIS is about to Rose in Boomtown. So
right. Yeah, and I mean, I think that at least in the new series, it's never been a question of whether or not the TARDIS was more than just a ship. Like every time we've gotten reference to her, it's almost always been a, you know, talking about her as a character, as a person, as, you know, more than just a piece of machinery. And I mean, we've had those mm-hmm. times where, you know, she breaks down, something's wrong, you know, it's more like a broken down car or something like that. But there's always that personal connection with it. It's always she. It's never it. It's, you know, right. It's always got that character to it.
Well, take Runaway Bride.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tenth goes and refers to some of the issues that she's going through as physical pains, and he describes it as indigestion. You know, he's trying to make light of it, but it's just the fact that, you know, you've got a living creature in pain or in discomfort, and as a result, the behavior is erratic. When it comes to erratic behavior, though, that opens up a whole other can of worms as far as the relationship between the Doctor and his TARDIS, because they are at times at odds with one another over where they're headed or where they're supposed to be or the reason why they didn't end up where he originally intended. And note that we are intentionally avoiding a very obvious reference for a later episode because we're going to spend a bit of time discussing that. But Moffat came up with a very interesting discussion as he was including within one of the compendium books that has been written during the 50th anniversary year. And he was saying that, you know, as the Doctor goes through his centuries traveling with her and having his adventures with her, through her, and along with her, you know, he comes to her aid as often as she does to him. You know, he offers his services as her repair and her doctor at times, learns from her as she exposes him to things or forces him into situations where he has to make certain realizations. And over these centuries, as we learn more about him, we learn more about her. That allows Moffat and some of the other principal writers to be able to do more with her as a character.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really interesting unfolding. You know, as you mentioned, Jake, you know, we've got so much more of that personification and characterization within what you want to, I'm sorry, folks, I'm going to keep using this term, New Who, because of the fact that we've established such a great foundation with the decades prior. Now we can start really treating her as another character, a principal character within the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that we've gotten some great examples of this too. I mean, like if you think about like the silence in the library and the Forest of the Dead, when River tells the Doctor that, you know, my doctor can open the TARDIS doors with a snap of his fingers. And then we see at the end of the episode where the Doctor snaps his fingers and the doors open. And that's like, wait a minute, that's not, you know, this isn't voice activated. There's no sound. There's something thinking inside the TARDIS. There's something that recognizes the Doctor's intention instead of just a control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the first real indication that we get. I mean, aside from just, you know, explanation, but that's the first real sign that there's something going on more than just switches and levers.
Absolutely. I mean, we see a lot of instances where there is that symbiotic relationship and ways where the TARDIS knows the Doctor as well as he knows her. I mean, we see so many instances within Sixth Doctor where Baker is, you know, he's got his jacket off and he's been monkeying around with something, trying to constantly do the repairs that he deems necessary to her that ends up, you know, causing more havoc than help. So he's this constant state of being the tinkerer. Tenth always sort of came into things, you know, with a roll of duct tape under his arm. And you could see it from the way he designed his control room, for crying out loud.
Oh,
there
yeah.
was like styrofoam wrapped around the railings with duct tape, and it was just a hot mess because of the fact that he was so ADHD, really, that that he didn't have time to do any sort of very finesse repairs. So rather than opening up the rondels, which weren't there anymore, you know, and going in there and doing some welding and things, he just, you know, slapped some tape on it and ran along. Then we get to Smith, And he really started treating her as that real dear friend, you know. You see him down below the console, hanging from the wires on a sling, you know, with the goggles on and working at her. That was a labor of love.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute. But she did the same for him, you know. I think back to Castrovalva. Okay, so you've got Fifth Doctor dealing with a very rough regeneration, extremely rough, very disoriented, very out of sorts, still very much physically in pain. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that the TARDIS does is provide him with a set of clothes. He didn't go through a choice process on that one because he was in such a bad shape. She gave him the cricket outfit and gave him a wheelchair to keep him steady until he was on his feet again. So yeah, the caretaking definitely went both ways.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's something that we've seen throughout the entirety of the series is that, you know, when no matter what happens, the Doctor, you know, loses companions, they leave, he leaves them, they die, whatever the case is, the TARDIS is always there. And you can see that relationship grow between the two of them, too. You know, it's, I mean, they really are an old married couple at times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I mean,
you're going to know that. Take all the aspects that you would take of people that have been, you know, sort of running buddies for any amount of time, whether it's a platonic relationship or a romantic relationship or a deep rooted friendship or what have you. As you start to get to know somebody very well, you're also going to know, you know, to a certain degree, what things are going to be helpful or toxic to that other individual. And so go ahead, take a look at any of the responses to Clara. Initially, you know, think about, you know, she's acting like an old cow.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't let her in at times until she was understood. And I'm thinking about Hyde in particular, that whole, you know, argument outside the door.
That was brilliant, too.
Or any of the times in the past where there were arguments between the Doctor and the console about... Oh, yeah. I'll call them behavioral arguments, where she either decides that this is not where you're going to go, or no, I'm not going to take off right now. And since there was no real clear communication or ability to communicate at that point, it really just became sort of this one-sided screaming match. But it happened through, God, I know, a Seventh Doctor, numerous occurrences, a couple. Fourth Doctor was a little more patient with her, but still admitted the fact that she was, you know, temperamental, I think, right, as he described it. That was about as stern as he got with her. You know, Third Doctor just treated her with a lot of respect because he was without her for so long, and absence making the heart grow fonder. As soon as he had her back and operational again, he revered her highly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, because we know that bond is so close that, well, as we saw, if the Time Lord that is psychically, and it is a psychic link, mm-hmm, that's connected between the two. And that's one of the reasons why the translation mechanisms work as they do, is because on that psychic level of connection with all the occupants. But once that Time Lord dies, hence name of the Doctor, the TARDIS begins to die as well. So, I mean, you talk about the true symbiosis. You know, when the host and the guest cannot survive without one another, that's about as deep as it can possibly run.
Let's take a look at, I mean, some of the episodes that we've seen this play out in. I mean, obviously we talked about it a little bit, but Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, you know, this is the most recent that we've had that, I mean, really did kind of showcase the TARDIS's, you know, ability to make decisions and things like that. And, you know, when what's his name steals the orb off the tree, you know, she starts blocking hallways and putting them in circles and things like that. And it's really actively working towards something and, you know, making the decisions instead of just, you know, it doesn't feel like programming. It feels like a conscious effort.
Right. Yeah. And I think to a certain degree, when you've got something that is, that it follows its own life cycle. So, and the thing that fascinates me about the TARDIS, and one of the things that is often often alluded to, but they never really, well, until some of the very specific instances, had not dealt with the fact that she, as a sentient being, cannot, or it is actually difficult for her to interpret behavior of any chronologically linear being.
Mm-hmm.
Because her perception of the universe does not follow any chronological order. So, and it's such a complex thing to wrap your head around, is the idea of being able to see all events as present, or all permutations of events as likely, you know, and again, we're dancing around the one episode in particular that does such a great job of being able to toy with this and put it into some more layman's terms. But just the idea that you've got a companion with you that cannot always communicate clearly with you, but knows the risk factors or the imminent dangers of anything that you choose or will choose to do is a fascinating literary concept.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Know? And the way that we've gotten those little tidbits up, you know, throughout the series, you know, just the little nods that we get and the, you know, just, not even mentions, but things that you can interpret certain ways that just lend so much life to the character if you're paying attention to it. You know, those are the moments that I absolutely love, is when, you know, something happens and it can just be a standard action or something that doesn't, but if you understand what the TARDIS is and who she is, you understand that's, you know, it's her telling the Doctor something, or it's her making a judgment call or something like that. And they've put, you know, everyone behind the show understands the TARDIS as a character instead of just as a ship. And they put that kind of stuff in there. And it's absolutely brilliant. And it really brings her to life when you stop and think about it.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it's really a matter of there's I don't think there's a point anymore where with any episode that's been written, you know, or can be written at this point, that will not treat her with characterization and personification in mind. Mm-hmm. You know, the days of being able to treat it as, you know, as machinery or as the, you know, as the, I think the master himself once referred to her as an overweight, you know, underpowered museum piece, and you might as well just try to fly a gas stove, you know, sort of thing, because that's the way he treated his TARDIS, you know, which had all the same capabilities, even had a functioning chameleon circuit. Go figure. But it's something where at this point there's absolutely no arguing that this is an integral part of the Doctor's existence. The two of them are inseparable. And even though you may have instances where she disappears at times, either for her own protection or because, you know, she's being sent off for a strategic effort. I've gone through a number of audiobooks where it's actually in the best interests of the characters for that particular scenario to send the TARDIS away, because the existence of this odd blue crate, you know, as it often gets described, would cause more questions than can be dealt with at the time. But it's always done with a degree of reverence and respect that you would give to any close character. You know, this isn't just the taxi driver who showed up at the beginning of episode, you know, 40 whatever. You throw one quick line at him, you know, throw a couple of pounds his way and let him drive off. This is somebody who you're going to need. I know the we knew from speaking of New Who in particular, wasn't it? It was 10th Doctor, I think, in Impossible Planet, who described that they were that the earliest inceptions of the TARDIS, they're on the grid, they're grown, not built.
Right, and that actually comes into play in a deleted scene, actually, from Journey's End, I think.
Okay,
when the, you know, when Handy Doctor goes off with Rose, and I know people hate it when I call him that, but screw it, he's Handy Doctor. But when, you know, the deleted scene was that the Doctor actually gives Handy Doctor a little chunk that looks like coral, and it's a TARDIS root, basically. I forget the technical term that he uses, but it's something that that Handy Doctor can plant and grow himself another TARDIS.
Precisely. Yeah.
So yeah, that's something that they filmed, recorded. It just got cut before the final edit. So I know David Tennant and RTD and a lot of people have consider that canon, because it is part of the script and it was in there. It just didn't make the time cut.
Oh, so. Yeah. No, and that's absolutely legit. And I would consider that canon as well, because of the fact that was based on a lot of the understanding of the inherent nature of the life cycle of a TARDIS to begin with. So, you know, that's they're actually assembled, if you want to, you know, follow the true canon on it. It's one of the Time Lord's own secrets, where they use what they refer to as block transfer mathematic equations, and they create a space-time event that actually is the birthmark of the TARDIS. So you have this the immense power of this Eye of Harmony. So you're dealing with one of the most powerful forces in creation as far as the amount of potential energy. And that is the womb in which the heart of the TARDIS is actually born. So these events end up becoming harnessed, coded, and are recurrent to create, you know, these, well, whatever, these TARDIS farms or however. I'm sure they've got a much more creative name for it. But it's a TARDIS farm.
Which that's the field where cool. We grow the tubes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they refer to it, you know, in a general sense as the hyperloom, but that's, I don't even understand what the hell the half of that is about. So that's when they start getting into a level of technical aspects on these where I just rather see a nice cool story and some aliens, you know. So but that whole idea of a creature of a being that has that life cycle, but that life cycle and all of the things, because of the fact that it is built upon and is in full cognizance of the breadth and scope of the time vortex, I can't imagine what that does, or what sort of a sentient mind is required to understand the fact that it is a mortal being. You know, it does have a beginning and an end to its life cycle, and yet it's seeing all time and all permutations at all times. Mm-hmm. Then it's absolutely no wonder to me that when they end up actually manifesting her in a human form, see where I'm headed here, that she's depicted as a mad woman.
Yeah. I mean,
because our brains couldn't possibly comprehend all those things.
And so, you know, obviously the best episode at personifying a TARDIS would be the Doctor's wife, you know, when we actually see her as a person. And we see that in the very first, you know, the first line that we get from her when, yeah, she runs up and says hello. No, or she says goodbye and no, wait, hello. Or tenses are hard. It's like, yeah. It's like she can't understand. Like, you know, it's like she says, no, you're going to steal me. No, stole me. Have stole me. Yeah, something like that. It's, she can't keep it straight. You know, it's hard to tell what is going on at any given moment.
Well, because to her it really is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole idea of the sequence is there's very few instances where she sees genuine concern in some of the moment to moment, you know, muckabouts of all of these other, you know, these linear path creatures, because she already knows where conversation is headed.
Right.
You know, either within, you know, the next 15 or 20 minutes or so, or the whole explanation to Rory about the definition of petrichor that he doesn't get for a number of episodes, you know, and it's just, it's all these aspects of the fact that she functions on, literally, she functions on a plane that we can't fathom.
Exactly. Yeah, but, I mean, this is where we see the TARDIS really, you know, really communicate, and, you know, for the very first time, honestly, and really show the personality behind the, you know, all the switches and levers and wires. And yeah, you know, so seeing the Doctor actually get to have a conversation with her. And I mean, props to Neil Gaiman, because this is some of the best dialogue ever to go around the TARDIS. You know, the you know, like we've said at the top of the episode, you know, it's just like, you know, what does my door say? What does it say on my door? 700 years you've walked past it. What does it say? Well, it says pull to open. And what do? I push. You know, that little exchange right there just sums up that relationship so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just that, and for him to cram that all into that one little exchange is just brilliant.
It's one of the things that, I mean, obviously, if you're dealing with a relationship like this, which is quite possibly, you know, when you really take the full breadth and scope of what this program has provided its viewers, or at times readers, or at times listeners over the course of the past 50 years, is one of the most beautiful friendships you could possibly fathom. You know, the lengths that the two of these characters have gone to each other, you know, to the grave, beyond the grave, back from the grave, literally at times, is just absolutely gorgeous. It gets caught up at times in people just sort of loving some of the kitschy aspects of it, you know, yes, the, you know, River joking about the vorp sound as being
the parking brake,
the brakes on. Well, that's a cute line, and we all have a good laugh at it. We also know that that's not necessarily fact, because other TARDISes, including the Masters and the Time Meddlers, made the same sound. And there's times when you could land the TARDIS and not make the sound. Fourth Doctor did it three times in three different episodes where he landed the TARDIS and materialized without making a sound. But it was one of those things where it was considered an inherent nature of the vessel itself. But you're in all of these instances, we've got this again, I keep going back to the fact that it's almost a tragically beautiful aspect that you have these dear friends who know each other so well and have never been able to communicate.
Right.
As we think we would. And one of the only ways that they could, outside of this episode, would be to actually go down into the, you know, into the cloister and face the Eye of Harmony, face the heart of the TARDIS, be exposed to the full breadth and scope of the vortex, as Rose did, or as mm-hmm. Donna had done, which was both immensely powerful but also extremely damaging, mm-hmm. and is completely disallowed to Time Lords because they would become a god. So knowing that, you've got two friends who have to deal, who have to figure out a way to be able to be there for each other in every aspect possible without being able to openly communicate. And that's, I just see that as tragically beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I mean, you get that sense in The Doctor's Wife when, you know, at the very end, when Idris, when the TARDIS says goodbye, you know, when she tells the Doctor goodbye and, you know, says that she's alive and things like that. And it's, you know, you see the Doctor turn around and just, his face is just, he's destroyed saying goodbye to her, you know, and it really plays it out very well. And you really see the love between these two characters. And I mean, not romantically, but, you know, they are like the purest form of family. You know, there's no tag on it. There's no, you know, oh, parent, child, siblings, aunt, uncle, whatever. It's, they're just family, you know? So
it's, well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the family aspect, you can see that there is a, and it's not necessarily just because of the fact that they had, well, hello. I mean, they had Saran Jones playing Idris. So if you want to go to the romantic aspect of it, you could do a lot worse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's, let's just say I can understand why he calls her sexy now.
Yeah, precisely. But their relationship is, you know, you described that as an old couple, just in terms of the way that they bicker at times, or in their own little non-communicative way, sort of argue with one another. But just the give and take between the two of them is such that it sort of it transcends friendship and becomes something that is romantic in and of its nature. You know, this whole idea of, you know, giving everything that I have for you, and knowing that even down to an actual literal physical level, I cannot survive without you. You cannot survive without me.
Right.
Is something that is far more than what a lot of people might give credence for. The whole idea of just the interchange of the playing with the idea of theft, you know, the who stole who,
yeah,
kind of a thing, is just gorgeous. You know, we've even gotten reference to that in things like the Big Bang, or even going back to the Five Doctors, you know, where, you know, the whole idea of the theft of the TARDIS, or part of his rebellious move of taking her. I think, I don't know, there's one aspect that still sort of sticks with me, and I'm not really sure how I can quite resolve it. Maybe it's one of those things that's sort of left to personal interpretation, but take Name of the Doctor. Mm-hmm. When Claire's in the time stream, she's now scattered herself apart across the critical moments in the Doctor's timeline to see to his safety, which I then, you know, the penny dropped with me, and it became one of those things where I understood the TARDIS's treatment of Clara was not because of distrust, but jealousy.
Hmm.
The TARDIS had always been his protector.
Right.
And now you have another individual who has thrown herself across time to be that individual as well. I could see the jealous response in that.
Yeah.
And that's how I choose to interpret it.
No, yeah. I mean, I can definitely see that now that you mention it. It's not something that I thought about before, but yeah, I can totally see that. But
the only thing that I'm not quite getting, though, was because especially since we've now referenced the Doctor's wife and we have that wonderful discussion about the fact that, you know, I wanted to see the universe, so I stole a Time Lord and traveled with it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we saw in Name of the Doctor, he was prepared to jump into another unit. And Clara runs down the hallway and changes his mind. Now, that to me is a little bit, while it was made for a great scene, it still to me just seems like a bit of a clash of premise between everything that we had been handed prior. I'm still trying to justify that one.
Well, it's Doctor Who. You don't hold Doctor Who continuity against Doctor Who. It just doesn't work.
Well, when you're handing it to Stimo and he's doing one of his big grandiose montage moments, mm-hmm. where he says, "Look how much I'm doing with the show now, and look how much of the previous decades I'm referencing."
Right.
When he does that, he tries to be very, very crafty with canon without defying it. He does not try to defy canon. He tries to find ways to incorporate it in a way that made you say, "Oh, I never got that before."
Right.
That piece I'm not quite getting. So listeners, you know, feel free to chime in on this and help me out, because it's one aspect that has continually rubs me the wrong way. I'm just not getting it to a point where I'm satisfied.
Right. Okay. Yeah, if you can put that together, then please, by all means, let us know. Because I'd like an answer to that one, too, but it doesn't bother me nearly as much.
I can't sleep.
He's going to start taking hostages soon, people. Come on.
Yeah. But as for where we're headed from this point, I mean, I know a lot of people had said things like, okay, well, you know, we saw the Fields of Trenzalore, we saw the demise of the Doctor, we saw the fact that he was buried within his TARDIS, and, you know, those dimensional dams break down, and you end up with this gigantic vessel that is, you know, his monolith of a grave. But when we go inside, the desktop is the same as the 11th Doctor. What does that mean? Well, that... I don't think you're going to have to sweat that one too hard. But I think as far as where we go from here, you know, some people have already said, why aren't we getting, as filming continues right now for Capaldi's episodes, have we not seen any change of interiors or anything? Well, we didn't necessarily have TARDIS changes within any of our previous Doctors until well into their tenure.
Right.
So don't expect that for a while.
No, I mean, the whole thing with Matt Smith getting a new TARDIS when he came on was just, I mean, they were starting everything fresh. So it wasn't, I don't think that was, they were setting precedent. I think it was just like, okay, well, new Doctor, new companion, hey, new TARDIS, it fits, right. Let's go.
Oh, but even his interior changed twice anyway. So
yeah.
we went to the Lego Targets, as you like to refer to them so often. So, which is a nice element, you know, and the time rotor becoming this gigantic, you know, monstrosity over the console and such.
Right.
So.
Well, and I mean, the thing is, it's like we've got, you know, in the fourth Doctor, how many different control rooms did he have? You know, but it's a budget thing. You know, you think they just spent the money to build this set that, you know, well, they're going to use it for a while. They're not going to, oh, well, we shot 8 episodes. All right, scrap it. Let's start a new one. Yeah.
But they've been able to make use of that as well. They use that actually as a script element where they would say, okay, there are multiple control rooms in the TARDIS itself. I mean, I think, what episode was it most recently that I was coming across where, might have been a fifth Doctor episode, where he came stumbling across a sort of an abandoned control room. It wasn't...
Well, and the Doctor's wife. Yeah, they go into 9 and 10's control room.
You know, right.
And then that's the one that the House deletes to put them in the proper control room.
Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, you know, it might have been a Colin Baker episode, because I know one of the things that happened was as he's going through it, he had to toss one of Pertwee's coats aside as he, you know, dusts off the console. God, I haven't been in here in ages, you know. So there's just, you know, the whole idea of being able to use that as something where, you know, they have literally these two characters, and I'm going to refer to them this way, have had centuries of these adventures together, and yet it never ceases to surprise us, or even surprise him, when these new aspects or these forgotten little relics are stumbled across. Because I think, and it goes back to one of Moffat's statements, the fact that the more time that they spend together and we as the viewers get to see them interacting together, it now gives us more liberty and more of an opportunity to deepen that relationship because we have so much more of a foundation to stand on. So where that's headed from here, you know, is that something where we expect to see some sort of a new plateau reached with 12th and his TARDIS? Or TARDIS and her 12th, I should say, to be more accurate. I would imagine so, because, okay. I mean, pop culture adores the TARDIS.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right, so here's a question for you, and I'm going to pose this to all you listeners as well. If it could be done without being an obvious, you know, grab for new attention and stuff like that, if it weren't obviously just like a ploy to get more stuff, would you like the TARDIS to not take the role of the companion, but be like an ancillary companion? Almost, I'm thinking like just basically give the TARDIS a voice. If they could do it without violating canon or whatever, I mean, I know that they can't, but just theoretically, it's a journey. Walk with me. If they could do that and just basically have it be, you know, like Edie from Mass Effect, where you can talk to your ship, would you want that? Or do you think that she is best as a silent character?
I personally would say no. I think there is something to be said for the fact that that communication barrier, if there really is one, exists between the two of them. There could have, in all of the breadth and scope of all of the Gallifreyan and Time Lord technology at their disposal, or anything that they could glean from their interactions with the infinite number of species around the universe, if they couldn't put a voice command module on that control panel, why hadn't they done it to date? Because I think there was a conscious decision that says that as far as the behavior of this program, the fact that they do not openly communicate, you know, Dave and Hal, you know, whatever you want to, however you want to look at it, there is a reason why they do not have verbal discussions on screen. Okay. And that's because of the fact that like any book that leaves certain degrees to the imagination, we as the viewer or listener or reader are given to fill in her side of that conversation, or at least be left to wonder what her contribution to that discussion really is.
Right.
There's times when it seems like he's communicating with her, and we're just not picking up on her side of it. You know, he's gotten to know her signals and her behaviors, so they do communicate in a nonverbal sense, but I think that's more advantageous to us to be able to know, you know, that this is something where there's more going on than we're overtly privy to.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I have to agree. I think that there's the fact that she can't communicate with him is part of what makes the relationship so compelling. You know, if you gave her a voice and they could actually argue and have tiffs and things like that, it would almost cheapen the relationship. So I feel like the silence is necessary. But then again, if they want to bring back Saran Jones, I'm all for bringing her back. I mean, I'm just saying.
Yeah, why not? But I mean, those great moments where at a point of frustration where he just doesn't understand and he's slamming buttons and levers around and asking her, why are you doing this? If you got an explicit answer, well, okay. Well, mystery's over.
Yeah, true. Yeah, or I'm thinking back to like that old show, the Quantum Leap, when you know Sam would pop up in place, and there'd be 10 minutes of, oh, I don't understand what's going on, and then you'd have Al come in. It's like, oh, well, you're here to fix this. It's like, oh, well, okay, then that's our goal for the next hour.
Okay,
there is definitely that aspect to it. But I don't know. I think that there are probably people out there who would like to have that third voice in the TARDIS. You know, just you have the Doctor and the Companion, and then the TARDIS chiming in and stuff. It could be interesting, but I think I think that it would be a very good premise for a different show.
Well, you know, I was actually a little concerned about that when we got to Time of the Doctor, when Handles was hooked up to the console.
Yeah, I remember you saying something about that.
Yeah, I was really worried that, oh, crap, they've all of a sudden given the TARDIS a voice box, and it's this crappy Cyberman head. You know, no, I'm not getting on to the Handles love bandwagon. It's just not going to happen. I don't really care. You can drop kick the thing for all I care. But it's, I don't know, and that just solidified to me the fact that I didn't want that degree of open communication between the two, because it then just it it hands too much over to the viewer and doesn't allow for that degree of imaginative creativity that makes certain aspects of the show so perfect, you know, allowing us to try and figure out. And it leads to such great discussions among Whovians after the fact. As you know, oh, why did this happen? Oh, why did they end up, you know, or why did they make this call? Well, if it's all handed out to you, there's no room for discussion anymore. You know, the credits roll and you say, well, okay, next week.
Yeah. Well, if you disagree with us and you think that the TARDIS could use a voice at least, then, you know, write us in and let us know. And let us know your opinion and what your argument is for it. Because I'd love to hear from people that actually do want that, because it seems interesting to me. I can't get behind it. And I want to hear some other points of view.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's about all we've got for this week.
I can allow myself because I start getting emotional. You know, go ahead. You know, get yourself to about 20 minutes into The Doctor's Wife, and if you're not feeling a little bit worked up at that point, then you have no effing soul.
Exactly. I mean, this is a topic that we could stretch out for months. I mean, there's the stuff that we had to wade through just in like technical readouts to put the notes together for this show is just mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. So there's always something to touch on, but if you are interested in, you know, in reading some of that stuff, there's more than enough sites. We'll link to a couple of them in the show notes. But yeah, all kinds of stuff that you can find and read up on. So go check that out. But that's about all that we can give ourselves right now, because I know I could go for another couple hours talking about the TARDIS. It's just awesome.
Awesome, yeah. And thanks to the handful of folks who chimed in on this one in particular. It seems like everybody was sort of gravitating towards The Doctor's Wife, you know, not only just because of the sheer brilliance of the script itself, but because, you know, again, as we were discussing it, it gave so much, it gave us that quick moment, that little bit of insight to allow those two characters to connect in the viewer's eyes, mm-hmm. in a way that we hadn't had before. So thanks to, you know, Closet Brit and 21 Holland Park and all the others who have kind of jumped in and reinforced our thoughts and all our feels on that.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about some news.
We do have some interesting news this time around. News, rumors, suppositions, hypotheses, and outright lies. So why not?
Yeah, just typical week in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So the first big news is that we've actually gotten two writers that are confirmed for Series 8. We talked about Phil Ford before. He was the first one signed. The new one that has been confirmed is actually Steve Thompson. And his name might be seen on the credits for things like The Curse of the Black Spot and Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. Yeah, exactly.
But you know what? I'm not gonna besmirch that, though, because as we discussed, there were elements to be able to take it out of both of those episodes that had some quality to them. As just recently discussed right here this evening about, you know, some of the things that shows that he has a good grasp of some of the greater Whovian science involved. So, you know, Curse of the Black Spot might not be your particular cup of grog, but it's it does have some good standard storytelling aspects to it.
And I mean, he's also worked as part of the writing team for Sherlock. You know, he's worked very closely with Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss on Sherlock, so he's got some chops. I mean, there's stuff to be gotten. Yeah, so he's going to write episode 5 in series 8. So we've got a little bit before we get to that one, but that'll be exciting, and it's going to be directed by Douglas MacKinnon, who, I mean, he's done some stuff. He's done a few things. All right, what we're about to discuss next can very easily fall under the category of spoiler. So if you're sensitive to that, go ahead and just stop the recording now. You're not going to miss much, but this is very spoilery. It is all speculation at this point, but it is still spoilery.
Some of the other elements about what we're going to be seeing for the season kind of leads to some, we'll call it the rumor mill grinding back up to life again. I don't really know. This isn't being discussed to any great degree because of the fact that our beloved seventh Sylvester McCoy, you might know him, he's in this film, The Hobbit, they shoot it out in New Zealand, has sort of let it slip that that the master will be returning.
Yeah, and that's, you know, obviously major spoilers. I'll have to go back and put a tag on that.
Well, no, but that's if you choose to take his aspect on it. So if you do that, then everything starts to erupt about who that necessarily is going to be, because it was agreed upon quite some time back from John Sim himself that he was not ever going to return to the role, even if the role did get reprised. He would not be the one playing it by his choice. Okay. So a number of names started getting bandied about, and it seems like one of the ones that is getting the greater degree of support from cross-referencing among non-related sources would be that of the actor from the long-running Brit soap EastEnders. So that's we're dealing with our Steve John Shepherd, man with two first names. I don't really understand. But he has that great look. If you want to go out and search for him, he looks like if you trim that beard down to the devil's point sort of thing, you've got a return to your classic Roger Delgado master look, which could be great because he's in his early 40s or so. I have to check his IMDb references. But then you've got somebody who, you know, going back in keeping with casting him up against, you know, you had Sim, an actor in his mid-30s at the time that he was going up against the Doctor, or even early 30s. I'm not sure. But, you know, young Master, young Doctor. So now you've got a more wizened and learned, that's a curved saying, wrinkled and aged Doctor, going up against a little bit more of a seasoned Master, too. I have not personally seen any of his body of work. In fact, I'm going to be doing a little bit of research over this holiday weekend and playing around with some YouTube clips and seeing what I find about his chops. But I don't know. I mean, there's a reason why they've narrowed down some of the short list that's been hypothesized, Charles Dance being another, Michael Smiley and him out there. But I'm just glad to know that they're going to consider, especially because, you know, we've got a Doctor that's coming to it with this gravitas that Capaldi has, that they're going to go back to this arch nemesis idea again.
Right. I think that could be very exciting. We all love the Master. I mean, he's a great, great villain. And I mean, we've talked about him before. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I would have loved to have been surprised on, you know?
Well, you know, we don't know how much credence this really, really has. I mean, this was a hearsay from a Whovian celebrity that was not done in any official interviews.
Right.
I mean, it's all hanging on a tweet that was, you know, sort of all, not even third party. It could even be considered, you know, one-off third party as far as the way that it was referenced. And nothing has been really confirmed or denied about it since. And one of the great things from the BBC is when these things really start drumming up and they're striking a little bit too close to home, the BBC comes out with some carefully worded phrases to try and dispel it. But they're just putting up smoke screens, and you can tell they're putting up smoke screens. They haven't said anything about this. They're not even giving it any credence. So it could all be a giant misspeak for all
possibly,
we know.
Possibly, yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to see. There's no telling at this point.
Mm. One person who is not concerned, though, about the amount of press this is or is not getting would be our beloved Peter Capaldi, who has realized that it is time to do a little bit of a relocation.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me, and I'm gonna set this out here now, says to me that for all the people that are saying that he was already from the get-go planning on doing a one season and out, and we're gonna have another one season Doctor just like Eccleston, this gives me room for pause.
Right.
So yeah. Capaldi is selling his home, his Victorian mini castle that he shares with his wife, that he has been in for nearly 20 years. That he purchased for about, you know, £200,000 back in the 90s, and is now selling for $1.5 million.
Yeah.
So a nice markup.
Just slightly. Yeah. Got a little bit of pocket money on that one.
Yeah. Doing well. there's a couple links out there that actually show some of the. It's from the actual real estate listing, so you can get a chance to do a little virtual tour of Peter Capaldi's home, which is kind of cool. But that to me just says that he's preparing to keep himself a little bit more mobile and prepared to sort of center his base of operations closer to the Welsh territories if it came down to that. You know, if he's back to, you know, finding flats from year to year as opposed to being anchored to a two-decade home. That's kind of telling to me personally.
Right, yeah. Very much so. And on a side note, in this news story that we've got, the first picture of him, I'd love to see the Doctor sporting that look with the mustache and a little goatee.
Oh, yeah, looking like a cast member from Deadwood or something.
I mean, I think that's from he was shooting the Musketeers, and that's his Cardinal Richelieu get up, but I'd love to see the Doctor like that.
Oh, that's a great look. He'd be absolutely just intimidating as hell.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, the Master'd come up looking all evil. He's like, no, look, I got this. Just go away. Yeah.
I rock this crazy goatee harder than you got.
It'd be great.
Oh, but yeah. Anyway. So that's kind of our wrap up. We'll make sure that we provide all these links for you so you can get a chance to tour through them as well.
Yes.
Keep an eye out on site for links to some of the related materials, like some of the book materials that we've been reading through as well. We'll provide links so that you can find all that good stuff on Amazon, because it's definitely worth diving into. I'm going to try and do some posts over the weeks ahead as I've been digging through some recent releases from Big Finish Productions. I've been on a huge audiobook kick lately. I go through them in cycles and have been plowing through both old and new Big Finish material that I'll make sure that I link in there too, so people can chime in on those. I know we have a number of not only podcast listeners, but some pretty avid audiobook listeners as well. So I've got some recommendations on that regard. But again, I think I said this a while back, if you have not gotten an opportunity, if you've got a couple of gift cards left over from the holiday season things and you haven't burnt them up yet, get The Vault.
Oh, God.
Put it on your coffee table and take everything else on your coffee table and bat it to the floor. Because this is a beautiful little arrangement that goes through in chronological order from 63 to 2013 with great little insights on production notes and design decisions and all kinds of fascinating backstory information about the some of the more technical and the writing aspects of the show that you're just not going to find elsewhere. A lot of things that some information I've found in there about, you know, certain decades, like the decisions on Baker's outfit and things like that you just can't. I searched online and couldn't find any other related material that I've found in this book. I've just had a blast with it. So highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely go check that out. And you can find a link to that in the show notes as well. GallifreyPublicRadio.com/77. It'll get you right there. But yeah, that's about all we've got for this week. So next week, we're actually going to be starting. We decided we're listening to some of you, and we're going to be doing our own Doctors Revisited. We're going to go through and start with the First Doctor and go through talking about each one. So next week, obviously, we're going to be doing the First Doctor.
Mm-hmm. I think, and this is not necessarily, we're not going to be treating it similarly to what you got in some of the broadcast Doctor Revisited, where they're just doing a bio piece on Hart or something of that sort. But this is more in terms of how we as viewers have been able to appreciate and incorporate the each of the Regeneration's contributions to the program as a whole. So, some discussions of the episodes themselves, characteristics of the Doctor's persona, and his relationships with his companions, and so go on that from week to week. So, we could start from the scientific curmudgeon, the angry grandpa.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So, this has been episode 77 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I wanted to see the universe, so I stole a Time Lord and ran away.
And this is Q saying, I'm
see you next week. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.